Inside Lacrosse Podcast.
Thanks for coming back to the Inside Lacrosse Podcast. I am Terry Foy, joined
with Dan Flynn.
Yes.
Dan, not Dave. Not what else did the guy call me? Oh, he thought that I was
Marcus Holman.
Because we referenced him once in the podcast.
And wow, I salty start.
I was like, but I even emailed the guy.
You're gonna call him out on the show?
No, I can't. But yeah, I sent somebody a nice note saying, "Hey, we mentioned you on our podcast," and he replied to me and was like, "Oh, so it made my day. Yeah, I listened to it already." Oh, I was surprised he even listened to it. I was like, "Wow, there are people who listen to this."
Yeah, man, we're getting massive reach.
Yeah, we're getting people are listening. And he said, "Yeah, I couldn't believe that Terry Foy and Marcus Holman thought enough of
me to mention
my name during." And I was like, "That was me, and I'm the guy who emailed you." So I thought it was pretty funny.
That is very funny. But the salt is well explained. You're a guy who had three of his teams losing succession yesterday.
Oh, I'm bitter. So I had a big Sunday set up on the couch watching games. Arsenal playing Manchester United, a injured Manchester United team without Wayne Rooney, and we got beat bad. It was 3-2, terrible loss. And then my Hopkins Blue Jays, terrible start, terrible finish. Nice middle part of the game. And I was able to get outside and grill during halftime. So that was definitely the highlight, was the second halftime and third quarters of that game for me. But then my Duke Blue Devils basketball team got destroyed at Pittsburgh. So I went 0-for-3, or the trifecta of suckitude, as I was describing it.
I hope that most of our listeners have absolutely no sympathy for you, because you just reeled off.
Yeah, everybody hates those teams.
A litany of teams that are pretty much hated.
That's what I was thinking about. I was like, wow, there's something about the teams that I like. That, you know, I do like the Orioles and the Ravens and the Phillies, and, you know, I grew up in outside of Philadelphia, between Baltimore and Philadelphia, and I like the Philly teams and the Baltimore teams. So I don't like all, like, the front runner-y
type
of teams.
Yeah, you're not a Yankee fan.
Yeah, I don't like the Yankees and the Cowboys and, you know.
The Lakers.
Yeah, so I don't like all those teams, but yeah, yesterday was my bandwagon kind of team day, and we went 0-for-3.
You didn't have an opportunity to watch the Notre Dame football spring game?
I love Notre Dame, too. My grandfather went to Notre Dame. My grandfather played football at Notre Dame. He was on the team with Newt Rockne.
All right, so as long as you just, you know, are like a long...
And I went to Hopkins,
too. A distant relative of Arsene Wenger, then everything's all explained.
I kind of went over how I liked Arsenal the first
time. We don't need to revisit that. Yeah. But, Dan, the highlight of my day yesterday was also at halftime of the Hopkins-Carolina game, because I dabbled in Periscope.
Tell me all about this. You were Periscoping with other fans who were watching the game.
Yeah.
I'm not too up to date on this technology.
All right, so shout out to Kyle Devitt, who has been trying to get me to buy into Periscope for a really long time. And what sold me was Clay Travis, the college football Fox personality, I believe, really got into doing a Periscope session during halftime of big SEC football games. And I like the interaction. So basically, like, the way you set it up is it's kind of like Vine in the sense that it's linked to your Twitter account. And, you know, this was the first time I was trying it out. I had no idea what to expect, so I didn't really want to shine a bright spotlight on myself. So I didn't tell people I was doing this or whatever. I just set the link
live.
Soft-sold
it.
Yeah, very much so. And but it's cool because once people join, then they can ask you questions through the app. So, like, it's Twitter connected, but you don't have to tweet a question at somebody in order for them to see the question. So it promotes some pretty good interaction that way. And I got like 5 or 6 questions over the course of a.
What was the best question you got?
Well, people wanted. I mean, so this is what happens.
I hope someone asked you, why isn't the offense going through Shaq Stanway?
Well, the best question I got, I guess you could ask, or you could say, is what channel is it on?
That's always like the one that kills you. You're like,
pretty much. But no, I mean, everybody loves to ask who's going to win the national championship, who's going to win the tour, and it's always like those big picture questions. I feel like I've got a pretty.
Did they spell Twarton right?
All right, we can get to that later on in the show. There was a pretty vicious example of spelling Twarton that appeared over the course of the weekend. But yeah, so that was great. But Dan, so we're really excited because we're back in the same room again.
Yeah, this is the first time in 3 weeks since our first one.
That we're sitting here in the ILHQ. And we did our listeners a favor, upgrading the technology.
Big time.
And I got to give you a nod on that one, because I have a certain threshold of embracing technology. Like, I'll figure out what I need to do in order to get the job done, but don't really make substantial investments in quality beyond that. And you blew past me.
Yeah, I play music. I play the guitar and sing a little bit. I'm not very good. I learned how to play the guitar when I was 33 years old. No one does that. No, I mean, that's unusual that you pick up an instrument at a later age. And I don't really have a musical background, but I have all this stuff. Like, we're talking in the mics, and we have
the blue snowball mic is sitting over in the corner, very jealous, envious.
Yeah, we were sharing a mic across the table, and that's why our audio quality wasn't so great the first few podcasts. But I hope it's better now. I hope you guys will enjoy this, and we'll be able to implement some new technology. Well, I went out and bought a mixing board. I didn't realize that this product was something that I needed in my personal life. This USB mixing board that you just plug into your computer and you can record and different channels and stuff, and then add stuff. And it was a product that I wanted, and I knew that I needed it, but I didn't know it existed until I did a little bit of podcast research, and I was like, oh yeah, it's probably been available for 10 years and I'm just missing the boat. So I went out, and it was on sale. I got it, and so I bought this myself, and then all this other stuff I just brought in, and we're looking very professional.
No doubt. I'm really nervous. I got a Coke Zero sitting here, and I'm afraid it's going to topple over. And usually you would say, oh, it's going to ruin about $10,000 worth of equipment, but fortunately this mixing board was like $85, right?
$99 from our friends at Musician's Friend. Got it on sale. Use some promo code.
Sponsor alert.
Yeah.
So let's dive into the news. And, well, actually, you know what? There is one thing that we wanted to talk about.
Well, you were up in Boston.
Yeah.
And Terry got his hands on the Warp. You got to see the Warp.
I had a big day in Boston on Friday. So visited with the folks at La Crosse Sports Network, appeared on their airwaves in the afternoon. That was really fun, gracious enough.
What'd you talk about?
We were all over the board. So I got my shoes called out by Josh Hawkins, and which point for not rocking New Balance shoes, which was the
Those
second time.
Bright
that
yellow
day
ones
that
were
happened.
You wearing?
No, I was just wearing Chucks.
Oh, okay.
And but I called in reverse him out for wearing man capris. Which he's able to pull
in
off.
In Boston?
I know. His ankles were
in
very
February?
Cold. Yeah.
What's up with that?
But yes, did spend some time at New Balance headquarters with the Warrior folks and got my hands on the Warp. We were able to take them over to Boston University and shoot on that and be able to watch a little bit of the Terriers practice in advance of their dramatic overtime
nice
win over
word.
The Naval Academy. It was great. We got to visit with Coach Ryan Polly, who's one of my favorites. And I left that session. I needed to come back to Baltimore to run the website on Saturday so that Matt Kinnear would be free to attend a pair of Division III games. But I was really reluctant to leave because I got the sense as I was walking out the door, I'm like, man, Ryan feels really good about this game. I would do well to stick around.
Now, was it just the confident our teams practiced well, we look good, we're ready to play, or was it almost like an overconfidence?
No, it was definitely the former. I would say that, you know, they're still in a position where they don't have any seniors on the team, but they know that they recruited well. They've got talent. They had a couple of guys that were banged up. Cal Dearth was back for his second game. And he's just a difference maker. He's a 6'3", big, dodging midfielder who can make defenses pay attention. But I felt like they had a pretty good read on Navy, who they are, what they were going to try to do. It was interesting because I asked him, you know, the Terriers started 6-2 last year, went down to Annapolis, lost, and didn't win a game the rest of the season. So I asked him whether or not his team identified that as like a source of their season unending or unwinding or unraveling. And his comment was funny. He's like, no, I don't think our kids are smart enough to remember that. But the point was that, you know, they weren't circling this as a revenge game. I think they were circling it as an opportunity game, you know, the type of win that could really solidify their program. Even though they've racked up a good number of wins, I think this would have been their, you know, they won 6 games last year, 3 the year before, and this is their 4-1 now. So this was their 13th win in 3 seasons. You know, I think that they hadn't had a win over an opponent that was ranked as highly as Navy. So this is a nice one for them.
We can get into a little bit later, but I want to make sure we come back to
the Warp.
A great week for newer programs.
Yeah.
Some big wins.
Absolutely.
All right, so the Warp.
Yeah, so I guess I'll put it this way. I'm a goalie, so I'm not a very good shooter. But when it comes to the Warp, that speaks to two things, consistency and ease of use. The pocket is integrated into the the head of the stick. So you don't have to worry about adjusting your pocket if you feel like it's not thrown right, because you can't. You're not even able to. And, you know, the material, this one of the big selling points of the material is that, you know, it is impacted by weather, whether it's wet or humidity. None of those factors impacts the performance of the head. So it's kind of like, I make the comparison, I drive a beach cruiser to and from the office, and even though it's kind of funny looking, it's not the most efficient means of transportation, it's a single speed bike with coaster brake, so you don't have to worry about the brakes or the transmission. And then also, you know, it's got fenders, so I can ride it in all weather. It's basically the Warp of bicycle. I was gonna draw that word out, and there's really no way to do
well,
it.
Can the Warp come in like a sweet black matte finish? Like
not yet,
bike?
But I have a feeling it's gonna be on its way. So anyway, but the reason I give that preamble is because my feeling is that it needs to perform at a certain threshold in order for it to be usable among elite players. And my opinion, having experienced shooting with it, is that it meets that threshold. Now, do I think that it is going to be, right now, when they release it in two pockets, mid and low, will it be so universally adopted that it'll meet everybody's standards? No, I don't think so. But I think they understand that. And I think that in the future, there will be a lot more ability to tailor the pocket to your style of play and what you like. But the merits of the head, the merits of the pocket, the merits of the technology, I think, hold up really well. So I was impressed coming away from having an opportunity to play some catch and shoot with it. But if you don't play with a mid or a low pocket, it takes a lot of getting used to, because, you know, it really doesn't have a lot of whip. You kind of get a lot of click off the top of the plastic. So, you know, there's some things about it that I feel like a lot of guys who are particular about their sticks are not going to like. But, you know, as Denver's Tyler Pace has shown, there are guys that fall in love with it and won't use anything else.
Pretty good Friday for you. You hit Lack Sports Network, then New Balance,
yep,
and over to BU. Solid day.
And
solid
I dropped day. By the Major League Lacrosse office as well. Said hello to Commissioner Gross. I mean, it was a whirlwind, man. Now, granted, all of those things are like in a 10-block radius, so it wasn't actually that whirlwindish. Yeah. But it was a good day.
Nice.
And in sitting in the bar on the way back, I texted you about, now yeah, I know why everybody hates Grayson Allen, because yeah, that was the first time I saw the highlight of him tripping a player against Florida State. We're not going to let you go on that rant, Dan. I'm sorry. I already had to listen to it once today, but I'm going to use it as a segue into the news and notes, which is that lacrosse was once again on the pages of Deadspin because a Oregon player.
Yeah.
I don't know how to describe it. She received a one-game suspension for hitting a Detroit Titan opponent with her stick on three separate occasions away from the ball. The video demonstrates that it's a pretty unsportsmanlike use of her stick.
It was vicious. It was. It was. There's no place for that in all sports, but you know, in lacrosse, especially women's lacrosse without a helmet. We need a page there. We need like a web page where we can post like the videos and our Twitter follow of the week and put some other like news and notes from our podcast on.
Okay.
Like we should just build that so that people can go back and like if we reference a picture, like last week we talked about Mark Millen's tweet about the bird taking it. We need to post that video for people. We need to post this video on this page of the Oregon girl and so people can watch it for themselves and follow along with us.
You're absolutely right.
So we'll do that. Yeah, it was how would you describe it? Like she's basically, you know, she's got her she's right-handed. And her player would, you know, her defender or the person she was guarding behind her, and she would just, like, wrap her stick around her head. Like, she's trying to throw a behind-the-back pass, but
Doesn't have the ball.
Didn't have the ball. The stick would hit the other opponent in the face, and she did it three different times.
Yeah. One time it was a little bit more, like, in the actual course of play than it was the other two times, and I felt like that is a little bit of a distinguishing factor. Like, you can kind of get away with it if there's, a lot of players around you. And I'm not trying to provide a reason for, or, like, a tips for how to get away with it. I'm just saying that there were two instances in which there was, you know, the ball was not even in the frame and she did it. And it was like, wow, that's really egregious.
Do you remember a few years ago in like the Mountain West women's soccer tournament and someone like pulled down by her ponytail? Like it kind of reminded me of that.
It was very similar of that.
Kind of reminded me of that. It was, so what she's been, her coach suspended her for one game. She missed the next match. And I think she got pulled out of that game and didn't play again. So, do you think that's a fair punishment? I mean, I do. I mean, you set the person, the kid aside and say, look, you can't do that. And
well, yeah. I mean, whether or not that's a fair punishment, I think that the amount of attention that it's received certainly justifies the – I mean, that is a part of the punishment, right?
Yeah, completely.
Her name being attached to it is something that's going to follow her around for a long time.
Yeah, and that's you never get that back. You know, like your good name is always – you have to really work hard to earn that back. So another news and notes, Charlie Toomey.
Yeah, this is like the opposite end of the spectrum.
Yeah, let's switch to some good news. He gets his 100th win. I don't know if there's a guy who does not like Charlie Toomey. Great guy, great coach, picks up his 100th win.
Yeah, so as a Loyola alum, I was on campus when he took over the program. And, this is a program that had just reached amazing heights under Dave Cottle. And then in the interim, after Cottle departed to go to College Park, took some steps back. And, there was a lot of factors. There was a lot that has happened since Charlie took over, certainly. The opening of the Ridley Athletic Complex and then the joining of the Patriot League are two really substantial ones. But I think that it's impossible. I will say this. When he took over in the winter of 2006, among relatively difficult circumstances, you could not have convinced me that the program was going to average 10 wins a season over the next decade. It was much less win a national championship. I mean, what the heights that they have reached are really, really remarkable. And there are two things about Charlie's approach and style that I really appreciate. The first is, there are some examples of, or anecdotes of, players that weren't necessarily starters, weren't contributors, not top of the roster type guys that were struggling, had some personal setbacks and were really looked after by the coaching staff and the administration. And so, that kind of sets the baseline for the level of respect I have for his program, that athletic department, that university. And then in addition to that, he has been successful in terms of producing winning teams with multiple styles and multiple types of players coming into the program. And that demonstrates a flexibility and an ability to adjust that I think is so difficult to commend properly among a coach. It's easier to win as a coach who has a regimented style that knows how to plug in the holes and kind of has his pick of the litter in terms of the players that are meant to do that. It's much more difficult, in my opinion, to do that with JUCO transfers, but grad transfers from Bucknell versus a transfer from Army or North Carolina plus all these kids that slip through the cracks recruiting wise, and then now they're in the top five with a team that's in the Patriot League versus winning a national championship in the ECAC. I mean, it's just such apples to oranges type comparisons, but they figure it out and they do it all while playing a really appealing style and having cultivated a really impressive fan base over the last 10 years. I mean, just tremendous credit to Charlie for what he's done.
I've always said in any sport, I think the best coaches are the ones who take the team they have, the talent they have, and then mold the style of play and how they're coached to the strengths of that team. And he certainly seems like a coach who does that.
Well, and I also, I think that it would be foolish to have this conversation and not give a lot of credit to Matt Thuan, because he has been an incredibly stabilizing force to that coaching staff, as well as both Dan Shamati, who was, the offensive coordinator on the national championship team, and now then Dave Metzbauer, and now Ryan Moran. To do that, to be able to sustain that level of consistency, Metzi was the offensive coordinator on a team that I believe, they went 15-0 in the regular season in 2014, and then lost in the first round of the tournament to Albany, but certainly were among the best teams in the country. And then, obviously they're off to a nice start with wins over Virginia and Johns Hopkins this year. So, tremendous credit to what they've done.
Let's get to the games, because there's each time we talk about, I'm thinking about Loyola's game this week and some of
the, you want to like dive into the details.
I want to dive into it, Terry. So let's get to the games and for the first time, crack open the chips and the guac from Chipotle.
Do you want to explain why we're doing this? Do you remember?
Yeah, the men in Blazers. Terry's he gets a crunch right in. The men in Blazers, Terry's favorite podcast, the soccer guys. They crack a Guinness before they get to the games to talk about each week. And since Chipotle is beloved by fans, players, and outsiders of lacrosse, everybody likes Chipotle. It's kind of like Charlie Toomey. Terry thought that we would use that as our reference point and crack open the chips and guac when we start the
discussion. Do you think we would be able to get away with calling Charlie Toomey the Chipotle of lacrosse coaches?
I don't. There are some pros and cons of that comparison, and I'm thinking of some cons that may not make so much sense right now. But to the games, Yale, Maryland, a battle of top 10 teams. Last year, Yale got the better of them early in the season. Maryland comes back and wins one in the tournament on a controversial goal. They met again, and I was surprised that game was up in New Haven again.
Yeah. So I haven't talked to Tills about why they decided to go back-to-back trips to Connecticut. I feel like the most rational explanation is that Maryland wants to play a game in Connecticut because they know how fertile the recruiting ground is. And I know that it's very easy to overstate how important it is to play games in far-flung geographic locations where you want to be successful in a recruiting landscape. But, they're going to California this weekend for the second year in a row. Maryland has a team that, got a kid on their roster, Lucas Gradinger, who's from Southern California. There's benefits to being in front of, those prospective players. Certainly the ones that are current, high school freshmen and sophomores, but probably even more so anybody that's between first and eighth grade who theoretically might want to or might be a high D1 player. If you have an opportunity to be, particularly in Southern California where there isn't a ton of Division I lacrosse, if you're one of the teams that's consistently in front of them, set yourself apart as being a potential destination when it comes time to start those recruiting battles.
And they have some of their prominent former players are in Southern California that we know and we're friends with. So it kind of makes sense that they get out there and just get in front of those kids at least once a year, and it should pay off for them.
Shake some hands with some friends of the program as well.
So one interesting thing about this game, Terry, is that there's a little bit of a trend that teams that they're losing some of the statistical categories that are usually indicative of winning the game, but Yale gets out ground ball, out shot, and they still win the game. So it kind of goes to I want your opinion on what that means, and then two, I'd like to make comment it really just the score on the scoreboard, and then times the ball goes in the net is really what counts, and that's what determines who wins and loses.
Absolutely, and I think that from an offensive and defensive efficiency standpoint, that's the way to overcome a possession disadvantage. So Maryland was really, really good at the faceoff X, and just able to control the pace of the game, and particularly that's a recipe for victory for Maryland. I mean, they're a team that is incredibly efficient offensively and defensively. But they turned the ball over 18 times, the Terps did, and the really, really struggled offensively from a shooting perspective. That's not as much of a surprise. Maryland has traditionally been one of the worst shooting teams among elite D1. However, that stat is skewed, and this is something that I kind of believe as opposed to know, but I think that they're more willing to take a possession shot in order to avoid the shot clock than most. And as a result, through the first 57 minutes, Maryland only scored 3 goals. You give a lot of credit to what Yale was able to do defensively, but it really felt like a good portion of that was just Maryland couldn't win their individual matchups against Yale's defensive players. And so it wasn't as if there was one particular guy that stood out. I think Michael Quinn is an MLL draft pick. He's a guy that deserves a lot of attention. He gets in the Yale defense. Riley Natan scored a goal. So certainly those two guys, are folks that you're going to point to, but I don't think that those guys outplayed any of the other 4 to 6 guys who contributed to Yale's defensive effort, including goalie Phil Hufford. I thought that at the other end of the field, Yale is actually very similar, I think, in their approach to games as Maryland is, which is that if they feel like there is an opponent they can just run past, blow the doors off, they will do that. But when they get into a really competitive athletic outcome, they're not going to try to push the tempo dramatically in order to give their opponent a lot of opportunities, a lot of extra possessions, particularly in a game when they're already suffering from a possession disadvantage. I thought that Yale was really efficient offensively, and I think that for me, and I know that this isn't, for example, on the Epic Isle Game Day video, Jeff Shannon explained that he thought the difference in the game was Yale's really impressive athletic advantage in the middle of the field. It's not a surprise. Something that I think folks at Inside Lacrosse are going to pay special attention to, because in talking to Andy Shea and talking to Graham Neamey and talking to some of the other folks associated with that program, they've been very open since losing to Syracuse in the 2013 NCAA tournament about how important that was for them, how important it was to recruit athletes that could compete at the ACC level, because they felt like they won at either end of the field. They felt like they lost in the middle of the field in that game. That was their trip to the quarterfinals. It was at College Park. It was a potential program swinging type of result. If you win that game and go to the Final Four, now you're a Final Four team. So, but for me, the factor in the outcome of this game was, you know, Ben Reeves, a sophomore who had a great season. I love Ben Reeves?
Yeah, you do.
Really?
Yeah.
Elaborate.
Well, you were talking about other Yale attackmen.
Yeah.
And how he kind of reminds you, fits in like with those guys.
Sure. Yeah, no, he's a part of the lineage. So I think now you look back about 6 or 7 years, and it goes from Brendan Gibson to Matt Gibson to Brandon Mangan to last year Conrad Oberbeck. These are, you know, top flight attackmen. These are, you know, trigger quarterback style players. You know, even though Matt Gibson is now best known as kind of a wing shooter for the Lizards, like when he was a senior at Yale, he was the guy that had the ball in his stick. And now they've got their guy for the next 3 years. If Ben Reeves can stay healthy, he's tall. He reminds me of Conrad Oberbeck in his approach. And he finished with a goal and 3 assists. And I felt like was the difference in the outcome of the game. I mean, his 4 points, obviously, you know, if you don't get those 4 points, you don't win a game in which you won 8-5. It's not that simple, obviously. But to me, he was what kept Maryland's defense on their heels.
And you said, we talked about this earlier, there was one guy from Maryland who stood out to you as a guy who can win matchups.
Yeah, I thought Colin Heacock, particularly late in the game, and this was before, I think he scored one of those 2 goals to narrow the margin in the last 3 minutes. But even before that, I felt like he was getting looks, able to beat his man, potentially draw a slide, depending on how Yale wanted to approach it. I was surprised. He was being covered with a short stick for a good amount of the second half, and I thought that was just a decision that I wouldn't have made because I didn't feel like there was somebody that had demonstrated the ability to beat a short stick on the Maryland midfield, whereas I thought that, you know, if you had bumped the pole up to him. And so now as you look ahead to this game against Notre Dame, I mean, that would be where I would put the priority. That being said, you know, I wouldn't be stunned if Maryland actually makes a relatively significant move in terms of, you know, their top nine offense. I don't know what it would be. There's a lot of guys on the bench that you feel like might be able to provide a spark, and there's always the possibility of seeing if Pat Young can run with the first midfield line. I mean, they were definitely a little bit less strict or less concrete with their who was running with whom than they had been previously, but I thought that, you know, it seems like this is a Maryland offense that could be in store for a shakeup.
On to another huge game this weekend that was at Homewood Field on a really nice – you got one more point?
Yeah. So we mentioned, and typically, you know, our broadcast webcast observation of the week comes at this right around this juncture in the podcast. I want to point out what we referenced earlier, which was the spelling of Tewarton.
Okay.
So it was in this game. I believe Michael Quinn was a Tewarton watch list honoree. He received that news earlier the week of the game. The way in which Tewarton is spelled. Now, Tewarton is not an easy word to spell. I've probably misspelled it a few times, but I have written it probably a few thousand times at this point, so I have it down pretty good. It's Tewaraton. So now you can hear it spelled, you can hear it said, and you can understand why the phonetic pronunciation might be a little bit more difficult. But on the webcast of this game, they decided to take a stab at Tewaraton. So it's kind of just like throwing a lot of A's in there.
And
I know where you're going with this.
This is the Yale, Maryland, at Yale. My nephew is a sophomore at Yale, and my niece is a senior at Yale. Maybe they were involved in the broadcast.
I thought that you were going to take the very easy, oh, that Ivy League education's going real far, huh?
Well, I could say that, but I have two relatives who are currently students in New Haven, and it's kind of embarrassing.
Tewarton. It kind of sounds, you know, the Ermagerd meme that, no?
Yeah, I don't know what you're talking about.
All right, well, basically it's something that emanated as far as I can tell.
That is way off. That is way off.
Yeah, no, it feels like the Ermagerd pronunciation.
Oh, God. Okay, that's good. Let's move on, though, to Homewood. Beautiful day in Baltimore yesterday. You know, we talk a lot about the bad weather in the early season. Yesterday, February 28th, and they got a beautiful day. Play the game in front of a nice crowd. It felt like the kind of game that could be later in the season, except it looked like a scrimmage at times in how sloppy the play was.
I mean, yeah, it was remarkable. And I think that what was particularly remarkable about that to me was that Hopkins was really sloppy in the first half against Loyola. This was something that I expected him to clean up, you know, identify the problem and fix it. Now, that being said, I think that they're, you know, Coach Pastrmalo said postgame, I believe three of the starters didn't practice all week. Shaq is banged up. Dismuke didn't practice. Obviously, Drew Sapinski, who had been a first-line midfielder, didn't play.
What's wrong with Sapinski?
They weren't clear. I'm pretty sure it's a shoulder. Yeah, I mean, the hits keep coming. Yeah. You know, he made it clear, Petro did, that these aren't excuses. You can understand where that's coming from. I mean, typically, I would agree. Well, typically, I would kind of disregard that comment as being a little bit coach speak and make the you know, might be a media crutch counter argument of like, yeah, they're like injuries can be excuses, but they also can be reasons. But Hopkins' struggles were not a function of their offensive problems or their offensive injuries. They couldn't get the ball from the defensive end to the offensive end of the field.
It looked like a lot of unforced errors, too. Like Carolina, their ride was pretty good, but a lot of those were just not throwing and catching passes.
Well, so there were 8 turnovers in the first quarter. 5 of them were committed by Hopkins' non-offensive personnel. So, you know, whether that be a goalie or a close defenseman or a midfielder who was involved in the clear, I think that they failed 3 clears. So, you know, there were 2 additional turnovers that weren't in kind of clearing mode. But yeah, I mean, it was that. And so really just kind of opening up the context of this game a little bit. So Hopkins falls behind, largely a function of these turnovers.
6-2 at one point.
Battles back, takes an 11-10 lead into the fourth quarter. And then you, I think, correctly identified the turning point in the game.
Yeah. Hopkins up 11-10, and they have 2 shots right in front of the UNC cage. And the goalie makes 2 really nice saves.
Brian Balcom, who I think...
Yeah, Balcom.
You gotta give a tip of the cap to him. You know, Kieran Burke was expected to be a starter when last season ended, and I think that he demonstrated that there's not going to be a significant drop-off in Carolina goaltending just because of, you know, his being a first-time starter.
So Balcom makes those 2 saves right in front of the goal. They get it down to the other end of the field, and that's when Turnbaugh can't get the ball out of his stick, and he fumbles it 2 different times.
Okay, so I have a theory on that. Now, having seen...
They kind of get like an open net goal, and it ties it up, and there's a big difference at that point where you maybe have a 2-goal lead where you've been behind, but, you know, I thought that, I mean, Hopkins didn't score again after that, so.
Carolina outscores Hopkins 6-2 in the final frame to go on to a 15-11 victory. I thought that that play, I mean, I'm pretty sure that that Turnbaugh blew out a sidewall string, because when he... So he's got the ball. He's in the crease. He goes for his 2nd cradle, and it looks like he's about to get rid of the ball. The ball flies out of the stick. It definitely did not look like he just lost it out the side of his stick. It looked like it went through the actual pocket.
Oh,
so then he runs, picks up the ground ball, gives another 2 cradles, loses the ball again. And at that point, I think there are 2 Carolina players on him, or the attacking comes up with GB, moves it once.
I think it was Cloutier, like, picks it up and throws it in front of the goal to his teammate. Yeah, and then right after that, Turnbaugh is like punching his pocket, saying like, "Hey, there's," and he goes to the sideline and gets a new stick.
Swaps out his stick, yeah.
So yeah, some equipment error there.
Got to be the worst feeling. So, as a former goalie, the worst feeling in the world was getting hit with a shot and then the ball ends up in the goal anyway. I mean, it's legitimately insult to injury. I mean, that is exactly how you would define insult to injury.
You are correct.
But it feels like that, not being able to trust your goalie stick twice to be able to hold on to the ball after making a save, which I believe he did. If not, he got a ground ball around the crease. Ugh, that's right up there.
Yeah. For me, watching at home with my buddy Brad, my Australian Brad, who is very opinionated and is not afraid to yell at the TV even in front of my children. He makes a point, their offense is so much better when Shaq Stanwyck controls the ball and operates and quarterbacks and makes plays.
So Mike Preston wrote a column in the Baltimore Sun last week after watching the Loyola game in which Shaq did not score, actually didn't take a shot, that he needed to be more assertive. I feel like to a degree this early in the season, sophomore, you know, it's not really warranted criticism, you know, particularly when there are rumors that, you know, he's playing a little bit banged up, got a back issue. That being said, there are 2 factors. The first is that Shaq Stanwyck is, you know, probably close to 6'2", probably about 185 pounds. Legitimately like a broad-shouldered individual, plus the fact that, you know, he is the last in a long legacy of really, really good players. None of those makes it permissible to criticize him in a way that you wouldn't criticize anybody else. However, it leads me to believe that of the guys that could handle that type of criticism, he's uniquely well-suited. He's been in the spotlight for a really long time.
I see where you're going.
But the one problem that I would have is, first of all, he was coming off of, he was two games removed from scoring the overtime game winner in Annapolis against Navy. And then secondly, I just have a hard time. I think I know lacrosse pretty well. I'm sure that Mike Preston feels like he knows lacrosse pretty well. There are coaches and players that I would feel comfortable criticizing their decision making. None of them have the last name Stanwyck. I mean, when you consider how far their accomplishments outpace what were probably their expectations based on their athletic profile, you got to give almost all of that credit to their work ethic and their savviness for the game. And so if Shaq is not in a position to take shots, then he's making the right choice. That's kind of my default position. That being said, 2 goals and 5 assists against North Carolina. Looked like he was playing with a little bit more spark. He's just tough to defend. There's no question about it. I mean, he just makes the right play. And, you know, I mean, you can tell this team without Connor Reed and Joel Tinney is going to be a team that's going to have to play like they did in 2014, where they moved the ball really well. They tried to find easy looks, and they relied on Ryan Brown to bail them out when they couldn't find easy looks on the doorstep that were finished by guys like Holden Cotone and Bronson Kelly. And they're going to have to play that way again this season. And again, I don't think that there are issues. I don't think that the reason that they lost to Carolina had anything to do with how their offense played.
No, it wasn't. A lot of it was just clearing the ball. And it doesn't seem like they have that one guy who can just get the ball, that midfielder who just comes in and clears it. They don't have a guy like that.
No, they absolutely don't. And I think that, you know, when you finish 17 for 23 in the clearing game and your opponent goes 16 for 18, that's just going to be hard to win, you know?
But, you know, we talked about it a couple weeks ago after the Loyola game. I don't think there's reason to panic right now. I mean, they are having a lot of injuries. Some of those guys will get healthy. And it's still February. It's a leap year. It's a leap year, though.
Yeah, happy leap year.
Yeah, it's February 29th. But they have to – the way lacrosse is set up now with so many teams now in conferences – you got to win your conference and get in your conference tournament, and that's where they're going to, you know, the season's not over for anybody right now. That's the cool thing about the conferences and the conference tournaments. You still have something to play for, even though you're a little behind the eight ball with 2 losses early in the season.
If I'm a nervous Hopkins fan, it's because I think that Rutgers has improved.
Yeah, then.
Penn State
looks Rutgers has the best record of any team in the Big Ten. They're the only undefeated team in the Big Ten.
Shout out to Brian Brecht. He's doing something right up there in Piscataway.
No, they haven't played anybody. And this week they have some.
Well, they haven't won over Army.
They haven't played a top 10 team, Terry.
And they haven't played a Big Ten.
And this week they're playing Wagner and Monmouth, which isn't going to help their profile and RPI a whole lot. But 3-0 is 3-0. You know, you can only beat the teams that are on the schedule and the ones in front of you.
Bonus broadcast observation of the week. It was a big week for hot mics. Anybody that was paying attention to the NFL combine coverage knows who the Cleveland Browns' next former quarterback is.
Carson
Wentz. I believe Carson that's Wentz. What we were talking about. And yeah. I believe it was, might have been Chris Rose who they caught saying that. Cleveland guy. If that's the case, then he gets,
factory
he gets
of sadness. Cleveland sports.
Hey, I love stadium nicknames like the Highlight Factory in Atlanta.
Yeah.
The phone booth, which I recently heard, the Verizon Center referred to.
The Big Sombrero. I hate when Berman does that stuff.
Well, the Big Sombrero is just a bad nickname. But yeah. Factory of Sadness is pretty top-notch. I mean, if that works its way into the common
It sounds menacing to opponents, but when you're talking about the home team, it's not so good. We're headed to Cleveland this Friday.
Yeah, we are. We'll see Coach Dylan Sheridan over there. I'm looking forward to it.
But yeah, Eamon, I think it was him at the top of the Hopkins Carolina broadcast. There was a hot mic that me and Brad rewound like 3 or 4 times to hear like what was going on. They were having some technical issues.
Yeah, a little bit of technical issues, but they worked through it.
They did.
Yeah, and it was, the technical issues seemed to mirror Hopkins' sloppiness, which is that they got better as the game went on.
Yeah, it was a Homewood Field thing. But let's move on, Terry. There's some other really good games, some overtime games, lots of overtime games. Hofstra.
4 overtime games.
Hofstra gets some validation over there, you know, some concerns that maybe it was their fluky win over UNC. They get an 11-10 win over Princeton. Colgate beats Bucknell 11-10. BU, we talked about that, in double overtime with a win, a 10-9 win over Navy. And then Harvard, the miracle.
Cardiac Crimson.
Yeah, Cardiac
Stealing Crimson. That one from Mark Dixon.
Gets a 10-9 win over UMass. It's the Harvard's third overtime win?
Yeah, they're 3-0, and they've won each game in overtime. It's a pretty remarkable run for Coach Wojcik's squad. But Quinn talked about this in his top 20 today. I mean, really it feels like the differentiating factor between going 9-5 and 5-9 is whether or not you win your one-goal games. And for Harvard to have already won three overtime games certainly demonstrates or seems to indicate that they're going to be on the positive side of that 9-5 type finish by virtue of what they've done this year. And Hofstra and Loyola, you know, two teams that have exceeded their preseason rankings to this point this year, were two of the teams that were most snake-bitten by one-goal losses last year.
I was just thinking about overtime and a couple other sports. Like in football in the NFL, now they have the rule where you just kind of, you know, it's not just decided by the coin toss who gets the ball first. Offense and defense have to get out on the field. In basketball, it's really just a continuation of the game. And anything can happen, but foul trouble and all that stuff weighs into it and bonus situations. In lacrosse.
Yeah, we saw Kevin Durant fall out on Saturday night of an epic regular season NBA matchup that Steph Curry
Wanna
finished.
Sidetrack with our Steph talk for a second?
Yeah, let's do it.
So, Terry, he was 12 of 16 from three-point range in a huge game on the road against a very good team. That's what guys shoot from the free throw line, and he's shooting it from three-point range. And then the 32-foot pull-up to game winner was sensational.
People talk about shooting from the logo, and usually it's like vastly exaggerated. Nobody actually referenced the fact that not only was he laterally at, like, there was still OKC logo, and by that I mean like the Oklahoma City Thunder's logo in the center of their floor. Steph shot from, there was logo between him and the baseline, and he was also laterally, so like if you, I don't know, XY axis, he was like not a straight shot, so he was closer to the sideline. I mean, that's where, when it comes down to a 32-footer, which I think was a little bit under, I would have put it 34, 35, just based on the mechanics of the math.
32.
I know, but that's what I'm saying. I think it was wrong. Like, I think that it was actually farther than that.
Okay. The on the broadcast guy said 35, but I looked it up, and it was 32. But still, it doesn't matter. It's,
I mean, I'll put
there's
it this
never
way.
Been a there's he's the best. He has the now the three best 3-point shooting seasons in a row. He breaks his record each year. They've only played 56 games, so he's got what 26 games left, and he already has the record. There's never been a shooter. I mean, he's unbelievable what he's doing, unbelievable.
Okay, so the first point I want to make is how much people have caught on to that, because Saturday night 11:30 on the East Coast. And Twitter is going crazy about a regular season NBA game. That just didn't happen. That's never happened in the history of the league. Like, I know that there are, you know, kind of measurable moments, but like, people talk about February in the NBA as being literally the doldrums of the season. And Steph and the Warriors have erased that. And the second point that I want to make is, so there, the conversation, these things happen in stages, you know, so Steph was a good player, but he was injury plagued. And as a result, he signed a very favorable deal that now we're seeing bear fruit for the Warriors. And then he is in the conversation as being the best shooter of all time. And now you're saying definitively he is the best shooter of all time. And I feel like a lot of people agree with that. That's not like an outrageous claim. So my question is, what does he have to do? When does he start entering the top 15 players of all time? When does he start entering the best players of all time conversation? Is it physically possible?
He's Kurt Warner.
Except that Kurt Warner was great.
But he's dominating in a small window. Or Gale Sayers, like someone who has dominated his sport in a small window of time. Now, we'll see if
But that's the thing, is that like Kurt Warner was like 32 when he was dominating in his small window of time. Steph is like 28. He's still got 4 or 5 years of his prime left, plus, you know, a post-prime that could be as long as almost any player in the NBA, because his skill set, you think he's just going to suddenly forget how to shoot free throws when he's 37 years old?
No, that's
like,
as
long as he wants to play basketball, I mean, you know, pretty much every team in the NBA, every playoff contending team wants Ray Allen to come back right now, and he hasn't played a game since June of 2014. Like, Steph Curry is going to be able to score points, dish assists, shoot incredibly well from the free throw line for 12 more years.
So, well, I mean, I was talking to someone this morning about it. They were saying, like, he just, it seems like he's come out of nowhere, kind of. But early in his NBA career, he had a lot of injury problems.
Yeah.
And he's been healthy the last few seasons, and it's must-see TV. You gotta watch.
So can a 6'3 point guard be in the conversation for the best player in NBA history?
The bar is pretty high. I mean, when you talk about MJ and Bird and Magic and
Bill Russell.
Russell and Chamberlain. And
LeBron James.
Yeah, and Oscar Robertson. I mean, there's been some amazing... I know, he's very topical.
Get Oscar Robertson's name.
He averaged a triple-double. He averaged a triple-double in the NBA.
That wasn't the point that I was going to make. He was a great player.
But...
Shout out Cincinnati Bearcats.
It's amazing what Steph Curry is doing. And to your point about a 6'3" point guard, we'll see. But he's just so good. You know, like I think that's the thing that is so amazing is he just looks like such a slight, you know, regular guy that it's that when you look at LeBron, you're like, that guy would be good at anything.
He's completely inaccessible. I think that's one of the things that...
LeBron looks like an action figure, and Steph Curry looks like the guy
that's
at
why,
the bar.
That's why kids
works
love
in
him.
Accounting down the you know,
that's
the
why
hall.
Kids love him, and I think that that's why... I mean, it's a similar phenomenon as to why I think... You know, the difference in the way that people are attracted to Paul Rabel, who is a lot more in the LeBron James category, versus Mike Powell, who is a lot more in the Steph Curry category. But you asked about overtime rules. That's how we got started on this tangent.
Yeah.
I am a fan of... You get more timeouts in overtime. I think that... In basketball, you should get an additional foul. And I think that as a result.
But my point is, I feel like the better team at the time, like there are factors that go into football and basketball. But in lacrosse, do you think the best team always wins overtime? Or do you feel like it's, do you win, if you win possession, usually there's a timeout and then you set up a play and.
Well, first of all, I would actually much prefer to see timeouts removed from overtime. I think that that functionality is so brutal. I remember being in a triple overtime game, and I believe it was a Hopkins-UMBC game at UMBC, and both teams, each time they got the ball into their box, called timeout immediately. And I just got to the point where I was like, the first team that doesn't call timeout is going to win the game because the defenses are clearly benefiting from being set up to prepare for the opposing offense more than the opposing offense is benefiting from being set up to run a play.
What game are you talking about? Hopkins, Virginia?
No, Hopkins UMBC like 3 years ago at UMBC.
Okay. I remember a Hopkins Virginia game that was on ESPNU, like a night game a few years ago.
Well, and there was,
where it was very much like
an epic Maryland Virginia game that went to 7 overtimes.
Yeah.
That was similar. And that's what happens. Those overtime periods get really long because everybody uses their timeout and each team has one. So, you know, it's essentially, it's almost the equivalent of like a 3 overtime per overtime because it's only 4 minutes. And those timeouts last 2 minutes, so you're adding four. It's just insane. To answer your question, I don't think that there's a significant deviation from the norm in how frequently the best team wins lacrosse overtime versus other sports.
Other sports. You don't feel like it's like a penalty kicks in soccer, where it's like...
No, I actually think it's much purer in that regard. That being said, I think that the Hofstra-Princeton result is pretty topical as it relates to this because people will point to the fact that Zach Currier, who is a really unique face-off guy in the way that he is not reliant on technique as much as he is athleticism, he wants to create a 50-50 ground ball and then he wants to run faster than you to get it, did that in the opening face-off of overtime. He was tripped. There was no call. Hofstra picks up the ball and Josh Byrne ends the game seconds later. You know, whether or not that should have been a loose ball push call, Quint is on the record saying he thinks it should have been. I was really surprised that the game wasn't stopped. I think it probably should have been as well. Those are the plays where the wrong team won, quote unquote, start to become a little bit more realistic. But that happens to everybody. That's not a function of which team was more deserving. It's a function of, oh, we were unfortunate to be on the bad end of a bad call or the wrong call or whatever. I mean, we saw it and talked about it a lot in the Hopkins Navy game as well.
So there were 4 OT games this on Saturday or this weekend, but there's a couple other games of note. You know, in inside lacrosse staff picks, Villanova Penn State was one of the games. I picked Penn State. It was at Penn State. I thought they were going to win that game.
Only two people picked Villanova.
I didn't think the result would be as dramatic as how bad Villanova seemed to beat them. But I thought that Penn State could win that game by 3 or 4 goals. Really surprised by that one.
Yeah. So I think that in order for that result to make sense, you have to believe that Harvard's pretty good because Harvard beat Villanova in overtime the week prior. Either that or you think that Penn State had a couple of paper tiger wins under their belt, most notably Cornell, who they had beaten the same day that Harvard beat Villanova in overtime. Wasn't able to keep a super close eye on this game. The one thing I'll say is that it felt like Penn State never – it wasn't as if they suffered from a knockout punch. It was that every time they scored – Villanova came back and answered and then put in another one or two for the effort. And the other you know, point that you can't talk about this game, Jake Vaccaro, who had been at Princeton, finished with 8 goals and 2 assists. This is not something that is totally out of the blue. He scored 10 goals against Yale when playing for Princeton once. He is right now, in my mind, the crown wearer for the Don't Let Him Get Hot award. Because when Jake Vaccaro gets hot, and there was a clip that Villanova circulated of all 8 of his goals, and you know most of these were feet set step downs, a couple shots on the run. I don't think he had a catch and finish, but it was just like, man, that guy knows how to put the ball in a place. And it was almost to the effect where once you get that hot, you're just going to – all you need to do is get it on net somewhere, and you're just going to let it go from everywhere. So he is my crown wearer for don't let Jake Vaccaro get hot.
And he got some help, though. Devin McNamara, 4 goals and assists. Christian Cuccinella with 4 goals. So they stuck it to Penn State. I was really surprised by that game.
Yeah, and you know, once again, this is a Penn State team that was coming off of a win over Cornell, who then turned around and beat Hobart by 2 goals in Florida this week. So, you know, there are folks that think Penn State's a top 20 team. You know, I think that some of their flaws were exposed a little bit against Villanova, and we'll see how they regroup going forward.
And another game with an interesting result. Syracuse survives Army West Point 9-8, and that game kind of slipped under the radar a little bit, but a great effort by Army.
In the way that playing at 4 o'clock on Sunday was its benefit against Albany a couple weeks prior, because so many folks had that game circled on their calendar, felt like this one was a little bit, like you said, unnoticed. And also, the other thing that happened was Syracuse built an early lead and Army came back only to hit the post late in the game to secure the Orange's 1-goal victory. It felt like Syracuse has to figure out a little bit in terms of some of their offensive personnel. You know, I think that they've got the talent. I was really probably most impressed by Army's ability to put up 8 goals on a defense that has been very stout to this point. So, you know, the Orange are a team that a lot of folks are going to see this week. And I think it's a game that a lot of people are going to form opinions off of.
Before we set up and talk about the games coming up, Terry, how about who's your Twitter follow of the week?
Well, right now, this was a pretty good week for Twitter, but there wasn't that one like kind of signature moment that we were able to sink our teeth into. So I want to shout out a guy named Frederick Plaisted, I believe is how you pronounce his last name. During the Brown-Stony Brook game, after the conclusion, or at least near the conclusion of Albany's win over Drexel, I tweeted, which game do you think is going to have more total goals? A couple of people responded, and Fred, I believe, correctly picked the Great Danes versus the Dragons. That game ended up with 34 goals. The Brown Bears 16-14 win over the Stony Brook Seawolves obviously only got to 30. But I'm excited. If this is a year where we are able to, you know, a couple times over the course of the season, say which game is going to be more in the 30-goal realm, more likely to be, yeah, that's a good game to be playing. So something to keep an eye on for the Twitter folks going forward.
Now, the week ahead, lots of good games on tap. If you're looking at the Cascade Maverick calendar on InsideLacrosse.com, there's 10 midweek games, including one is for the Battle of Baltimore.
Battle of North Baltimore, the Battle of York Road.
But are these the two best teams in Maryland right now, or the two hottest teams in the state of Maryland playing in this game?
Well, that question shines a bright spotlight on the fact that it's a bummer that Maryland doesn't play more of these games. I didn't realize until this weekend that Maryland isn't playing Loyola, which they did last year. I was like, man, Loyola's got a good schedule with Virginia, Duke, and Loyola's got a good schedule with Virginia, Duke, and Maryland on it. Turns out they're not playing the Terps this year.
So the game I'm referencing is number 11 Towson, who had a nice win over Georgetown.
Oh, yeah, you didn't
Georgetown.
Say that yet.
Yeah, is playing at number 5 Loyola, 4 o'clock on Wednesday, midweek game. That's it's a significant.
So, I mean, you know, I think the question is, are the Tigers better than the Terps? You know, the Greyhounds are ranked ahead of Maryland right now, and I think you can be comfortable in that. It's not very difficult to imagine Loyola being better than Maryland. They were that, you know, in 2014 and 2012. I think at this point, certainly a lot of positive signs coming away from Towson's win over Georgetown last weekend. Ryan Drenner being, you know, an offensive catalyst helps. Towson is clearly going to be a team driven by its defense. And I think that you can kind of stand on the idea that Tyler White might be the best goalie in college lacrosse right now. And he's got a really...
Yeah, Quinn said that he thinks that could be the case.
And he's got a stout defense in front of him. But the question is, if they need to get to 10 or 11 or 12 goals, do they have that talisman that can help drive them there? If it's going to be Ryan Drenner, then that's a comforting feeling for Anthony Gagliardi and his staff as they make decisions about how to build the Tiger offense, particularly knowing that they've got some weapons, particularly Spencer Parks, that they can get some value out of in rounding out the Tiger attack.
Whoever wins this game is going to be feeling very good about themselves with another feather in their cap kind of win.
Yeah, I mean, for Towson, it'll be their second top 20 win, and for Loyola, it'll be their third. You know, those are the types of things that if you can stack that up, you don't have to rely on your conference AQ at the end of the season.
Yeah. The game...
And not only that, but the other side of that is that I don't think either of these losses are going to fall out of the top 20. Just because, you know, if Towson loses, that doesn't mean that Towson's not going to be a top 20 team at the end of the season. So Loyola can still, more likely than not, count on that win as mattering on Selection Sunday.
Terry, what do you think a home field is worth in terms of advantage in lacrosse?
I think that it probably makes sense to do a goal and a half or two goals. Now, if you do the two-goal thing, then you end up with more round numbers in terms of setting lines or spreads. Mm-hmm. And if you do a goal and a half, you end up with not. It kind of depends on, as a bookmaker, which would you rather have?
And what kind of crowd do you expect Loyola to have on Wednesday evening?
It's a really interesting question. It's a 4 p.m. start, so I would expect there to be a fair more number of folks there for the second half than there are for face-off.
Will the students come out like they did for Hopkins or some of the other notable games?
Kind of depends on the weather. I think it's going to be like
I'm looking up the weather right now.
Sunny. So let's put the over-under at 3,565.
What about a score prediction? It could rain. It's saying high of 57, 72% chance of rain on Wednesday.
Yikes.
Yeah. I don't know if it'll rain during game time, but
I like the Greyhounds to win 11-6.
Okay. This Friday on ESPNU, a game that I think a lot of our listeners will want to tune into. Number 3 Syracuse at number 14 Virginia. What are your thoughts on this? Virginia, I mentioned this early in the podcast, some of the up-and-coming programs, some of the newer programs had a great week. High Point getting a victory over UVA was huge. Marquette had a nice win over Richmond and BU, the Navy game we talked about. But Virginia, they need this really bad.
Struggle City. Yeah, and that's a good point. I mean, I think you're now 2 for 2, and this could be 3 for 3 on your this team needs this win really bad, because you said it about Villanova last week too. I don't know, man. So what Virginia was able to do against Penn was encouraging for a couple of reasons. The first is Jason Murphy has demonstrated some solidification at the faceoff X for Virginia, which is a luxury that they haven't really had very frequently over, like, legitimately the last decade. The last time there was a Virginia faceoff guy who I think you knew was going to be around 60% was Jack DeVille in 2006. So that's comforting for sure. Now, granted, Ben Williams is the type of guy that can ruin your day if you're a faceoff guy. I think that they were able to show more offensive diversity against Penn, and they were able to, I believe they put up 15 goals against a team that, while, you know, I think the thing that you need to keep in mind with Penn this season is that they started 5 freshmen in that game yesterday. it takes a while to grow into that as a team, including Noah Lehman starting in as a close defenseman and then starting a freshman in goal. That being said, I thought that Virginia offensively, Zed Williams played well. They showed – James Pinnock played well. They showed a little bit more diversity from their known quantities in terms of their ability to get on the board. So that's an encouraging sign. That being said, my expectation, my opinion of Syracuse right now is that they are very good defensively, that they're two close defensemen, their top two close defensemen in Mullins and Mellon can erase your two best attackmen. I'll be interested to see whether or not they bump someone up to Virginia's first midfield. I think that'll have a big impact on Virginia's offensive approach. I would say at this point, Syracuse is at least a five-goal favorite in Charlottesville.
Do you remember how big this game used to be? This was five, 6 years ago.
Game of the year. Yeah. I remember there were a couple of years when this game was not televised, and I thought fans were going to revolt. I thought they were going to storm ESPNU studios in Charlotte just to say, like, you got to get this game on TV, guys. Figure it out.
There were – I remember one year in particular. They've usually played, like, on a Friday evening. Like, this has been – like, the game time is not – it seems like this has happened before, and I remember like the whole staff
they
and Tyler Cross getting together a couple times.
Saturday at 1, I'll say that.
Yes.
You know, it's far flung. It's all over the board.
But I remember some evening games where, you know, our group got together somewhere, you know, to watch the game, and it was like a special event. Like, hey, wow, this game's on. Can't wait to see it. It's going to be up and down, lots of offense, you know, looking for like a 16-15 game where some of the best – half the All-Americans, second-team All-Americans will be playing. And that doesn't feel like the same this year.
It doesn't. I agree with you. But it's not as if this was a very far-removed thing. 2 years ago, I had never seen a game in Clockner. And so I went to Maryland-Duke early in the day and then drove to Charlottesville and was there on a Saturday night, 7 p.m. start. It was my first time, like I said, in Clockner. And it was awesome, electric. I believe it was Virginia's last win in their 6-0 start. I remember coming away from that game being like, they have so much balance in terms of their ability to shoot from the righty wing with James Bunnell and their lefty wing from Mark Cockerton. And at this point, you know, I still had the 2012 Loyola Greyhounds in my head with Eric Lusby and Mike Sawyer on the wings. I was like, these Cavaliers are primed for a deep run. It didn't manifest itself that way. And I believe, yeah, the Orange ended up losing to Duke in the national championship game. So, you know, the team's fortunes shifted a little bit after Virginia won that one. That night, it felt like this is why folks circle Virginia Syracuse on the calendar when that game time is announced at the beginning of the season.
Yeah, I agree with you. These two teams have great history. They've played in our face-off, the original face-off classics in Baltimore at the Raven Stadium. Featured Syracuse, Virginia, Hopkins, Princeton. So they've had a history of great matchups, lots of fun, entertaining lacrosse is the way I probably describe it, entertaining. And I just love to see that continue this year with an excellent game.
Yeah, and I wouldn't be stunned if it does. This is a Virginia team that's going to be focused. I think that, you know, that has demonstrated itself as being an issue. At home, on ESPNU against Syracuse, they're going to be focused. They're not going to lapse by virtue of coming off of a win over Penn. So that matters. If they play well, I think that they can maybe not necessarily go toe-to-toe, but compete a little bit more than they have and than they've shown a few times, most recently against High Point.
Clockner is a great facility. I've seen many games there. Great venue, and I hope that it is a madhouse this Friday. It'd be a lot of fun to watch on TV. So a couple other games. Some top 20 matchups. Number 2, Denver at number 10, North Carolina on ESPN3, tape delayed on ESPNU.
This will be a lot of folks' first opportunity to see the Pioneers this year. I'm very excited. I'm intrigued by one matchup. I want to see what Carolina does to try to slow down Connor Canizero. Our boy Javi asked
Javi
for a
from
matchup
Mexico.
Yep, Mexico. If I'm Carolina coming away from that matchup last night or game against Hopkins, I want to put Austin Pafani on and just see if he can win. You don't want to give Denver offense by creating a system that's complicated, by sliding unnecessarily. They're going to move the ball, And they're going to get some easy looks as a result. You're going to get your Zach Miller inside roles, probably going to get a Colin Wolford step down or two. Who knows what we're going to see in terms of Bromberry and some of the other guys that have emerged. Austin French is another one. But I feel like maybe the difference in whether or not you can keep pace in this game is if you don't let Cannizzaro get his 4 goals and 4 assists. And I feel like, you know, winning a matchup with your athletic defenseman is probably the – might not necessarily be the likeliest way to do it, but it's the easiest way to do it so that the cascading effects don't end up costing you the game, meaning that we're focusing so much attention on Cannizzaro that we're just totally leveraging our defense in the other direction.
Another big game, number 4 Duke, number 12 Harvard.
Playing this one at Hofstra. It's going to be on Lex Sports Network.
Why is it on the island?
I believe, first of all, Duke has played on the island a few neutral site games each of the last couple of seasons, and one per year. I want to say it's right around spring break, which this likely is. I believe that Denver played Penn State there last year.
A game that they play at it's like a benefit game that's up in like Cold Spring Harbor or something like that.
That was the case with that game.
Is that what this is?
No, I don't believe so. This is, I think, it's grouped with the Georgetown Hofstra game. So okay. That's a double header at Shure. Lex Sports Network is airing both. This is a game, this Duke-Harvard game has been a good game. Harvard beat them in that run of 2008 to 2010 when Duke couldn't win games in February, and they played them, as part of a 2 games in 1 weekend situation. I believe it was a 1-goal overtime game at some point in 2011 to 13 range. I believe that game was later in the year in Boston. So this is, this is one that there's a little bit of something going on between these two teams. I feel like, a lot of guys. I feel like a lot of guys are recruited by both of these teams. So, I think that matters as it relates to, your Peter Schwartz, a couple of guys over the course of time who, committed to one, went to the other.
Like George Loring.
Yeah, another guy who the George Loring Bowl, you can call this one if you want to, could get going to play for George.
I remember talking to him at one of our events in New England. And he had said he just switched his commitment from Duke to Harvard. And I was like, oh, that's a tough problem to have. I'm like, this kid is going to be successful in life. He's got a lot of good options.
Yeah. But I don't know if I necessarily have a good read on this game in terms of what I expect to happen. Haven't had an opportunity to watch Harvard very closely yet this season. So, I'll say this. Duke's not very difficult to figure out. You gotta let Miles Jones not put up 6 on you and then figure out all the other cards as they fall. Duke's coming off of a big win over Jacksonville, so I feel like this is the time of year where they get a lot better. Doesn't seem like they're making substantial changes to their offensive personnel. They're just playing a lot of guys. Case Mathias played really well against the Dolphins, which is also really nice to see. Jack Bruckner had a nice day as well. So
they played 44 guys against Jacksonville.
Yeah, it's awesome.
They're playing Mercer right now, I think.
Yeah,
as we speak. A game, so that you, as you said, that'll be on Lax Sports Network, along with the Hofstra Georgetown game, if you want to catch those. A game that won't be on TV that I think every lacrosse fan would like to see is the top-ranked Fighting Irish taking on number 8 Maryland in Southern California.
GW Mix bringing two top 10 squads out to the left coast. And, this is going to be a really good matchup. We've got Jacqueline Borowski and Dan Abern heading out to Los Angeles to take this one in for Inside Lacrosse. Really excited to see the content they produced. Jacqueline is going to be on the airplane with the Maryland Terrapins documenting their travel for the May issue of the magazine. There's going to be a lot of Under Armour in this game, which our boy Dave Cheney is certainly going to be very pumped about. That being said, so Notre Dame is coming off of wins over Bellarmine and Detroit. Difficult to take away too much from that. Yeah. Matt Kavanaugh didn't play against the Knights. He returned and played pretty well against the Titans. Mikey Wynn, huge day against Detroit. Sergio Perkovic, I believe, had 4 goals. Those two, I believe, accounted for 10 as Wynn picked up 6 of his own. So Notre Dame's offense is rounding into form in terms of what we expected it to be as long as Kavanaugh is able to play.
Is he expected to play?
Yes.
Okay.
having played, I say that only on the basis of the fact that he played in the most recent games. So there's no reason not to expect him to play going forward. We've talked about how staunch Notre Dame is defensively. We talked about how challenged Maryland is offensively. Talked about how potentially likely it is to see some shakeups in Maryland's top nine offensively. It's a tall order. Let me pose you a question. If you were in charge of Maryland's offense, the fact that you're playing the number one team in the country right around, not the midpoint of the season, but like a third of the way through the season, it's kind of reassessment time for a lot of folks. You're going to California. Last year they did it. It was around a spring break thing, so they were out there for a couple extra days.
Yeah, they're doing that again.
Would you be more or less inclined, particularly taking into account the most important factor, which is that Notre Dame is such a vaunted defense, but they are not sophisticated. They're not complicated. Maybe they are sophisticated, but they're not complicated. They're not tough to figure out in terms of what they're going to do. Would that make you more or less likely to make a drastic change? And by drastic, I mean inserting a new starting attackman or something like that.
I would change things up, or at least have some new wrinkle planned for this game that maybe they've been waiting to unveil at this game.
Yeah, I mean, coming off of a loss to Yale, I think that, you know, you feel a little silly if you were actually holding something back. But you can understand why Notre Dame would be circled on your calendar.
Well, I'm not saying that. I just mean maybe, like in football, you'd have a trick play or something that you're holding back on to use. So not like, but a lineup change could probably do that too. Just shake things up.
I think for Notre Dame, you want to see dominance almost. This is the opportunity to say we are definitively the number one team in the country. Now, again, if you're Notre Dame, you don't care about being the number one team in the country. Kevin Corcoran has been very clear about that. That being said, you do want to be better every day, every week. So this is an opportunity to demonstrate that emphatically. And not only that, but you also know that this has seeding implications for you. If you care about being the number one seed or the number two seed, this victory is going to be valuable as the season moves along. Maryland's RPI is always 5, 6, 7 under John Tillman, and you know the likelihood that it's going to be a top five win for you is pretty substantial.
Yeah, it's one of those. I wish there was a way to see it. I think they've sold a good number of tickets for this.
Yeah, they're over 5,500, expecting 6,000. So
stadium holds like 8 or something like that. It'll be a great one, and I'll be excited to see what our team of guys who are going out there to cover it will provide.
Well, so you mentioned the Face-Off Classic earlier. Yeah. This is the second large neutral site event so far in terms of the men's D1 season.
Mm-hmm.
Cleared 3,000 fans, cleared 3,000 $5 downloads at the Cobb County Classic last weekend. Jeff Shannon was on hand for that one. Notre Dame beat Georgetown, Denver beat Duke.
Yeah.
We talked about that would be a Face-Off Classic quality.
Yeah, definitely a great matchup.
You kind of want to give folks a little bit of a peek behind the curtain as to what stadium events are all about and where Inside Lacrosse currently sits in that realm after having developed, you know, a pretty substantial lineage of those events.
Yeah, so at one point, you know, Inside Lacrosse started with the Face-Off Classic, and the concept was to, you know, replicate that Final Four experience. Like, why does the season progress all year long with games that have about 3,000 to 5,000 fans on a good day, good gate, to the Final Four where, you know, at the time there were 50,000 people come to see the Final Four in 2007 at M&T Bank Stadium in Baltimore. And that's about when Inside Lacrosse started. I think it was 2007 with the first Face-Off Classic. And the concept was to take two games that would be successful on their own campus but put them in one place and give fans something to get excited about early in the season. And that was highly successful. And then we ended up having two events. We had the Big City Classic, and then we had another event in Baltimore called the Day of Rivals that had Maryland Hopkins and Army and Navy. And eventually we were doing four events. We did something in Denver a couple years, and we did a pretty good job of it. But things changed over time, you know, from 2007 to when we last did our event, I think in 2013. And we get asked all the time, Terry and I get asked all the time, like, how are you going to do those again? You know, when are you going to do another one? And every year we make plans and we investigate.
We explore
the possibilities. But really, a lot of things changed. And, you know, one of the things is it's steadily increasing costs. You know, it went from some coaches saying, like, this would be good for the sport, let's move it, and Inside Lacrosse saying, yeah, we'll pay for, you know, your meals and accommodations and travel, and, you know, we'll give you your team comp list, some tickets, to it was like running a football bowl game where we were buying games from schools and moving them and a lot of other financial arrangements, and escalating costs on our side, including the rental of the stadiums. Conference realignment really affected what we were doing. I used the Syracuse, Virginia example before, where we would say to Coach Starja, hey, we'll do this for 2 years. You give up a home game. Coach Desko will give up a home game. We'll meet you halfway in Baltimore. Your fan bases can get there, and we'll compensate schools, you know, the gate that you would have lost when it was your home game, et cetera, et cetera. But when the schools, when conference realignment started and teams were jumping into the ACC and other teams, it affected all this, the scheduling. This is why we're seeing some of these big games early and earlier and earlier. You know, our face-off classics were like the first week of March, and it was literally like the beginning of the season. Now the season's starting 3 or 4 weeks earlier.
I think that there's two functions of conference realignment. The first was that 2014 was a pivotal year in with respect to a lot of games, a lot of series were one-year deals because of the beginning of the Big Ten in 2015 and the way in which Maryland's move from the ACC to the Big Ten was impacting schedules in 2014. It made it very difficult. A lot of times you mentioned
It was very hard to do a two-year deal.
It was important to these coaches to do two-year deals because otherwise the home team coach felt like there was no reciprocal action from the visiting team coach. So it made it difficult to actually arrange these in 2014.
Yeah, they couldn't plan ahead. They didn't know what their schedule would be or when games would be slotted.
Nor were they willing to necessarily give up a game when they
didn't have the
coach doing the same thing the following year. Because
but also,
the game wasn't going to happen the following
but
year.
But also the conference seeding.
So that was the second part that I was going to get to, which is one of the things that we learned over time is weather has an enormous impact on the gate. And so it's just logical. You'd rather do it later in the season when the weather is more likely to be good. The Big Ten playing their five conference games in the sixth through second last week of the season essentially put it into a position where, you know, there are only so many programs that carry large enough profile and have large enough fan bases to justify, you know, these big stadium type treatment. And those games are so frequently now conference games or are dictated when they are by the conference. You know, we want to play a Saturday or a Sunday in April. There's just very few teams that are willing to move a matchup, particularly a conference matchup, into a neutral site venue, even if it is for 2 years. So now we're pretty limited in terms of the types of events that we'd be able to do, you know, given the markets that we want to play in and the teams that we want to have involved.
Exactly. We would probably have to have done a game. You know, the one that we talk about doing is the Big City Classic at the Meadowlands, which we would usually have 20,000 plus fans, and it was a great event, and profitable for Inside Lacrosse and great for the sport. And the teams involved, coaches always said it replicates the Final Four experience for our players so that when they arrive for the Final Four, it's a business trip and not, you know, they're not in awe of the big stadium and the NFL locker room and the fans and all that other stuff. But there was two other points that really have shifted that. The TV product is incredibly better than it used to be in 2007. You know, the fact that you can stay at home.
Well, the fact that you have ESPNU is something that very few people could say in 2007.
Yes.
Really through like 2012 when ESPNU made a big arrangement, a big deal with a lot of the cable players.
Yeah, and there wasn't streaming video back then. And, you know, a lacrosse fan can stay on their couch and watch games all day rather than go out. And to that point, a lot of the ESPN's production has been grade 8 lacrosse in high definition is a big part of that as well. But there's also another point. I think that there's only so much discretionary lacrosse money that families have to spend. and with a lot of other lacrosse activities, which I've developed in the last 10 years, club lacrosse and the summer circuit, for our audience of teenage boys, who are diehard lacrosse fans, who are mostly attending a lot of these events, their families are spending a lot more money outside of it. And these are some of the same reasons that Final Four has cited for their attendance going down as well.
Right. And those, all of those factors put us in a position where this is something that we're always going to explore, but unless the right opportunity presents itself, Inside Lacrosse is in a position to pursue making something happen, kind of, you know, making chicken salad out of chicken shit.
Yeah, and we've been very close. I mean, we've had some good conversations with the right people to try to bring that back for fans of lacrosse, and it just hasn't been financially prudent decisions on our. I mean, we just can't.
It's a much less vulgar way of saying what I just said.
Yeah, it just wouldn't make sense. So, kudos to the guys who are pulling it off. It's different though. I mean, I'm not afraid to say it. Our events were awesome, and people are trying to do it now, and they're doing a fine job. But you know, our events were in a football stadium, an NFL stadium, with 20,000 people, and they were on national TV. And I don't know if those days are gone or we can bring it back, but we're working at it. So who knows? In 2017, we might see another event like that.
I'm so glad that we had this conversation, because now whenever anybody asks me about it, I'm just going to be like, so fast forward to the 48-minute mark of our 2016 February 29th podcast.
Leap year podcast.
Yeah, exactly. That's the other thing, too, is that I think this podcast just goes away tomorrow. When it only expires. Happens on leap year. Yeah.
I'm glad you brought that up, Terry. I mean, we've been meaning to talk about that for a while, and we've never really given any kind of public explanation about it. And we do get asked that question all the time, especially this time of year. And it was nice to sort of be able to have a place to say that. That said, there's a couple of games that, a game that used to be in our Face-Off Classic staple, Hopkins versus Princeton. That's the game, you know, I'll be watching that on ESPN3. It's also tape delayed. The game's Saturday at like 1 o'clock. But you can, it's like Sunday mornings when they're going to re-air it, or 1 o'clock on Sunday. We need this one. The Blue Jays.
We're going to the Wii?
I'm 2 degrees from Hopkins, and I've also worked there.
So unprofessional.
I'm a fan. I'm a diehard Blue Jay fan. And, they need this win over Princeton.
Now it's a day.
Well,
you just
straightened me up, man. You just stood me up straight in my tracks.
It was a good game last year. Once again, I think Princeton's a team that this is going to be, in the same way that this is going to be a lot of folks' first look at Denver, I think, with their ESPNU appearance, I think it's going to be similar in the sense that, you know, some folks who didn't get an opportunity to see Princeton play against Hofstra are going to be able to see him play for the first time this year. And I think that, you know, a couple guys jump off the page immediately. Zach Currier had a great game against Hopkins last year, really announced himself as being on that elite D1 stage. You know, for the Blue Jays, it's about getting Shaq Stanley with the ball as much as possible, getting Ryan Brown his looks. It's going to be an exciting matchup. I'm very curious to see how it plays out. I think Princeton, the Wees at Princeton, are saying we need this one too.
Yeah, I'm sure of it. It's I just love when you get these kind of matchups, and you're just like, it just... You think back to all the games over the years between the two teams and the great players that have played in it. And I like the Syracuse Virginia game. I just want to see like that level of play, which I did not see out of Hopkins yesterday. But that level of focused, intense play. And I'm pretty sure we'll see that this Saturday. And then there's one other game that you have on our list here. BU is playing Canisius. Now BU is 4-1, 5 games under their belt.
Canisius is 0-0.
I haven't played a game yet. And I think that's significant because of a lot of reasons, but you want to elaborate on theory there?
No, I mean, I think it's tough to practice in Buffalo, New York. This game last year, it was impossible to find a place to play. Yeah. So the Golden Griffins are heading to Beantown, and, you know, curious to see what Randy Murns brings with him. He's a crazy creative guy, and... You lost to Hartford. Just saying. Upset alert.
First game out of the box for the Golden Griffins.
I can't imagine having not played a game and having 5 games of film to watch.
It's a lot. Can you imagine kids are like, can we just practice? We're watching more film.
Yeah.
More film.
And now you have to watch them beat Army, or I'm sorry, beat Navy in overtime.
Yeah.
Sounds horrible.
Double overtime.
Double overtime.
And we have gone to double overtime on this podcast,
this
Terry.
This is record setting.
Yeah. Last week we were both disappointed. You know, tough circumstances. You know, Terry was in, you know, on the road and, we didn't have a lot of time.
I think I set
to...
a record last week for the amount of ums that I threw out. Yeah. I just wasn't able to focus.
So we gave you a little bit of bonus time this week. Is there any...
Free of charge.
Free of charge. Are there any closing things you'd like to say about this week, upcoming games, the pod in general, our fan base?
Come on, you Spurs. Not only a lacrosse podcast talking soccer almost as much as they talk about lacrosse.
Somebody actually said to me is that they enjoyed our Premier League roundup to start the podcast. And I was like, you know, not a lot of other people agree with you, I don't think. But, yeah, Arsenal, it's a killer loss. And Terry's texting me during the game. He could not believe that they were losing to Swansea City. And of course, they came back and handily won the game. And then you had to be embarrassed at that text. It was such a panic text midway through the first half of that game.
I wasn't embarrassed. I was upset.
But
can't
looking
just
back,
emotions. We talked about the heights and valleys.
I know, but a 2-1 win, the way it ended up playing out, it was like it was never in doubt for Spurs.
Fabianski, the opposing goalie, who
former Arsenal
player, played one of the best games. I mean, he looked like Tim Howard versus Belgium in the 2014 World Cup. It was unbelievable.
He's
now
a
I know
good goalie.
What it might be.
He was my fantasy goalie like. Last year.
Oh, I was going to say
in Premier League, whatever ESPN's Premier League fantasy.
Could have really used him this week, right?
Yeah, could have. I don't have Peter Cech. He's having a good season.
All right, Dan. Any final comments from you?
No. I've enjoyed doing this, and I hope the sound quality is better. I think it will be.
Your final comment is, I hope the sound quality is better.
Yeah, after an hour and a half. I hope you guys don't mind the quality of this broadcast. But no, everybody have a good week. Lots of games to watch. Please send feedback to us. It's Dan Flynn. At dfly on Twitter or dflynn@insidelacrosse.com.
It's
or
not at dfly, it's at d_fly. Yeah. I realize that there's going to be a guy that's going to be getting comments about.
That's the thing, he's not getting any.
All right, solicit the feedback. Maybe we should do it at the beginning of the show.
We should work that in. But we'll put that on our page for the podcast.
There you go.
Along with some video links and pictures and things like that. But good week. Send us your feedback or tfoy. At insidelacrosse.com or at Terrence Foy on Twitter.
Thanks, Dan. We'll catch you next week.
See ya. Inside Lacrosse Podcast.